Session number 10745, Reel 2.
Mr. Gehring, Reel 2.
Yes, well, we didn't have a set routine for searching the sky when we were searching for enemy aircraft, but it wasn't only just the two gunners that were searching. I mean, the pilot would be looking round, the flight engineer would also be looking round, and with all the eyes looking round, I mean, we pretty well kept the whole of the air covered around our aircraft the whole time.
How often would you come back without having fired a shot?
Mostly we came back without firing a shot, because our job as air gunners wasn't so much to engage enemy aircraft, enemy fighter aircraft. Our job was to make sure that our aircraft got back. So our main task in the aircraft was to give the pilot instructions should we be attacked by enemy aircraft. I mean, we had set manoeuvres that we followed if we were attacked. We had to tell the pilot what manoeuvre to take and when to take it. So our job wasn't to go shooting our guns at everything in sight, as it were, but to act as part of the aeroplane, really, part of the pilot's eyes in a way. We used to have two manoeuvres, a diving turn and a corkscrew. Well, the pilot wouldn't have known when to do them, or which one to do, actually, or when to do them, so it was the air gunner's jobs to do that, you see. We did fire our guns, very often did fire our guns, but we came back mainly without firing them. I mean, I can remember one night we were over the Ruhr, and we were attacked by an enemy aircraft, and the rear gunner fired his guns. Two of his guns stopped firing. I fired my guns. Three of mine stopped firing, and we were lucky really to get away with it that night. But what had happened, we were using South African ammunition, and I suppose the 5th Column in South Africa, they used to put a dud bullet into the belt of the ammunition, you see. 303 ammunition it was. Of course, as soon as you got to a dud bullet, the gun stopped firing. You had to cock it again by hand, which is a bit of a panic, you know, when you're being attacked.
Could you be sure that it was the 5th Column?
Well, they did say that that's what it was. Yeah, because it was always this number one stoppage caused by this Duff ammunition, you see.
And did it only happen with the South African?
South African ammunition, yeah. That's what they said.
Was that the station commander?
Well, it was generally known, you know, when all these stoppages occurred. Oh, yes, that's some more of that Duff South African ammunition. Yeah. Whether it actually was, I don't know, but that's what was always said about it. And I remember we came back one night from somewhere or other, and we were diverted from our airfield, and we had to land at an American Liberator airfield near Norwich. And when they debriefed us, the debriefing officer was quite amazed that we hadn't shot down, you know, four or five German aircraft. You know, he wanted to know what we'd been doing. He said, well, that wasn't our job, really, to shoot them down. It was to make sure that we got back home.
Was he suggesting that the Americans were better?
Well, that was the implication, really. You know, I suppose that in daylight they may have been better, because, I mean, I think they had more aerial battles as such than we did. Being night time, you know, it wasn't quite the same. But he did seem quite surprised, you know, when, how many did you shoot down? None.
You mean at night time, bomber and the fighter could pass quite close to each other without ever having known they were there.
They could really, I would have thought, yes. Yes.
Would they be able to pass within gunfire range without you knowing?
They would. Oh, yes, they would. I mean, on the very, very dark nights, you just couldn't see anything at all. The only way you could make out another aircraft very often was the odd sort of flame from the exhausts, you see. I mean, you just couldn't see the aircraft. It'd be that dark.
In your turret, then, you had four guns?
Four guns, yes. Four Browning 303s.
Were they reliable, except
very
the South African ammunition?
Oh, yeah, they're very reliable gun, the Browning gun. Very.
Did you have to look after your own guns?
Yes, yes, we had to service our own guns and sort of fire them every day. Not up in the air, but on the ground. Not every day, not every day, but we had to make sure they were serviceable every day before we went. So,
how lengthy a job was that?
Well, we used to go down, usually we used to go down the flight in the morning, and we'd be down there a couple of hours doing that kind of work, checking over the guns and the turret.
Was the mid-upper gunner interchangeable with the tail end Charlie?
We could be, but we didn't interchange. We kept, you know, we kept to our own position.
Why was that?
Well, I suppose really we got used to our own position, and having got used to it, I mean, it's a bit like everything else. You feel more at home in your own position then, you see. But we could have interchanged if it needs be, but I mean, it just never happened that it was needs be, you know.
Was there a lot of difference in technique between the two?
No, no difference at all, actually.
Did you ever act as rear gunner?
No, I always flew as mid-upper gunner.
Now, you mentioned your first operation against the V1 site.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any other operations that stick out in your mind that can be related in detail? That are of particular interest?
Well, I suppose every one can be related in detail almost. They are so vivid, you know, vivid in your mind as to how they were. I mean, I can remember one Sunday, we did a daylight trip one Sunday morning, and we went over to Cleves in Germany.
Which month was this, do you remember? About?
I think it was in the autumn.
Autumn 44.
44, yes. It must have been in October 44, I think. It was a beautiful summer Sunday, autumn afternoon, sunny, nice sunny day, and there were all these trees with, you could see the bonfires, and the people on down below were obviously tending their gardens, and they had little bonfire smokes coming up, you know. And then suddenly we appeared on the scene, and it sort of altered the whole scene, as it were, because we were actually bombing Cleves, because there was a troop concentration there. That stuck in my mind, because I, you know, it struck me that it was such a peaceful scene when we arrived, and then it all changed so suddenly. And another day we went to Duisburg in the Ruhr, and we were there at about Sunday dinner time, and we really set Duisburg alight. We dropped loads of incendiary bombs. And on the Sunday night, about midnight, we were over there again. We were over there twice, really, in one day. Although it was just into the next day, really. And when we got there the second time, it was still burning from the morning raid. And it was a right inferno, that place, Duisburg. You could see the streets. You know, they were easily seen where the streets were, and they were all burning very fiercely. It must have been hell down there that night.
Which month was that?
That was in, I think that was in November. Now, from my logbook, I can see that it was actually the daylight one was on the 14th of October 1944, and we were over there about midday. That was a Sunday, and just into the 15th of October, we were there over there again. That was at about, just after midnight, really. So we were over there twice in one day. We always thought it was one day, you know. And then we went to a place called Stercrada in the Ruhr.
How do you spell that?
Sterkrade. And we were attacked by an ME-110 that night. But we managed to, I don't know whether we frightened him off or he frightened us off, but we got away anyway. Okay. Most of our operations were, as I said, over in the Ruhr. And we didn't really like bombing into the Ruhr because it was the concentration of flak was so intense there. They had what they called box flak. They had kind of a box in the sky that was absolutely full of, you know, anti-aircraft fire, and where as you flew up to this, it didn't look possible that anything could ever get through it, because it was so, you know, it was all over the sky was these flashings of these exploding anti-aircraft shells, and You marvelled that anything could get through it, but most of them sailed through. I mean, the odd ones got knocked down by it. But I often used to look and wonder to myself whether we would get through it. But we did. We were fortunate. And the longest ones I did was... One was to a place called Böhlen, near Leipzig.
How do you spell that?
B-O-H-L-E-N, and that lasted 8.5 hours, that trip.
What was the target there, if you can remember?
Well, it was just Böhlen itself, because by this time the Germans were drawing back from Russia, and their eastern cities, they were crowded out with German troops, so that was when they were bombing those cities to try and knock as many of their troops out as possible.
When was that?
That was in 13th of February 1945. And on the 14th of February 1945, we went to a place called Chemnitz for the same thing. And that night was the night of the Dresden firestorm raid. We saw that. I mean, it wasn't far away from where we were. We were really a kind of a diversionary raid. The RAF very often did that. They had, you know, small forces going to different targets so that they were never quite sure what the main target was going to be, you see. And the night of the Dresden raid was the night we went to Chemnitz.
Could you see that anything special was happening at
Dresden? Oh, yes, you could. You could see that something terrible was happening in Dresden, because it was just a vivid orange glow, you know, the whole sky was lit up. Was it?
Did you know it was Dresden then, or was it just somewhere over there?
No, we knew it was Dresden, because the navigator, you know, he looked and he said, yeah, that's Dresden. He could tell from his maps where it was. And that was a pretty grim night. Excuse me. And on those two nights, we actually flew out after we'd bombed. We flew on over the Russian lines in Czechoslovakia, you know, on our way back home. And that's why they were both very long trips, those two. And another one which really stuck out in my mind was the last the last trip I did of all, and that was a daylight trip on Cologne. I believe it was one of the last air age on Cologne, and Cologne seemed to be in absolute ruins. The whole of the city was in ruins except the cathedral, and it was just standing there amongst all the ruins. And of course, I mean, it obviously struck us as being rather strange that this one building had survived, because no one had really aimed to miss it. It just had been missed. And I suppose very much like St Paul's got missed, didn't it? But it did. You could see the cathedral standing amongst all these ruins, you know. Quite impressive, that was. That was the last one, the last trip of all.
When did you say that was?
That was the 2nd of March, 1945. So it was getting near the end of the war, really, by then, you see, wasn't it? And that was my 39th trip.
Can you tell me how much of a difference it was for you going on daylight raids as compared to nighttime raids? Did you have any preference yourself?
I preferred the nighttime raids, actually, because I think you felt a little safer in the dark. You weren't quite such an obvious target, although with modern range finders and things of that sort, I suppose one was never really very safe in the sky, but I think I felt a little safer at night time.
Which were you the more concerned about? Was it the fighters or the flak?
The flak I was always more concerned about, because I always felt that with fighters we had as much chance as they did, because we had lots of pairs of eyes looking for them. And if we saw them in time, we had more chance than they did, really, because we had more guns to bear. And, whereas with the flak, you had no chance. I mean, if you were unlucky, that was it, you know.
Did you ever shoot a fighter down, to your knowledge?
We damaged one night, but I couldn't claim that we shot it. It went down. But we couldn't claim that we shot it down, because I think other aircraft engaged it as well, all at the same time.
What happened on that occasion?
Well, this aircraft, which had been... It was rather strange, really. It attacked us, and it had a light on the front of it, which seems to be rather a silly state of affairs, to have like a searchlight on the front of it.
On its nose?
Yes, on its nose, yeah. And we were surprised to see this. We thought that it was just a dummy to take our attention while perhaps there are other fighters that would attack us. Anyway, we fired at this thing and it veered away. We appeared to hit this aircraft and it veered away. And when we got back to our debriefing, other aircraft also reported seeing it, firing at it, and seeing it go down. So, you know, we didn't know really what it was.
What kind of a plane was it?
It was twin engine. I should think it was a Messerschmitt 110 night fighter bomber.
Where and when was that?
That was actually at Steerkrater on the 18th of August, 1944. Yes.
Were you ever shot up badly?
The only time I was shot up, or the aircraft I was in was shot up, wasn't our aircraft. I was flying with a new crew. What they used to do, when a new crew used to come on the squadron, they used to put one member from an experienced crew to go in with the new crew, just to give them a little bit of just so they would know the kind of thing that was likely to happen. And I went over with a pilot to Brest. We were going to bomb Brest, some German ships in Brest, And we were damaged by flak that day. We had to crash land when we came back at Carnaby, which was our crash landing strip. Yes, so that's the only time we were shot up. We used to, when we came back from our operations, we used to have a quick look round the aircraft to see whether we'd been damaged. I mean, we used to get little bits of damage to the aircraft caused by flak splinters and things. We used to have a quick look round, even when we got back in the dark, just to, you know, just to see whether we had been damaged too much. And on one particular night when we got back, we had a quick look round. You couldn't look round too closely because obviously, you know, the light, weren't allowed to shine a lot of lights about, and we couldn't see anything had happened to our aeroplane. But the next day, in the daylight, when we got down there and we got all over the aircraft, when we got on top, we found that between the fuselage and the starboard inner air engine, there was a big hole in the top of the wing that was all jagged upwards. So we surmised what had happened was that, because they carried bombs in the inner sections of the wings, inboard sections of the wing, we surmised that the bomb doors had opened, the bombs had dropped, and before the bomb doors shut again, an anti-aircraft shell must have come straight up through and gone through the top skin of the wing, you see, and that is what we found the next day. So we counted ourselves lucky that night. You know,
did the crews ever get superstitious?
I think they did. Yes, I think they did. They used to carry certain things with them, you know, lucky mascots and things like that.
What did you carry?
I carried a scarf, actually, that my girlfriend had given me. Silk scarf. Yes.
Did you come across any instances of people who were accused of lack of moral fibre?
I only came across that once. There were two people in the same crew, and I think they'd had a pretty hairy experience, actually, and I really felt sorry for them, because there was a parade and they were stripped of their flying brevets. It was all rather sad, really. Looking back on it, you know, it seemed a bit unfair now.
What did people feel at the time, though?
Well, at the time, people thought that that's fair enough, you know, if you're accused of cowardice, which is what it amounted to, really, as far as LMF is concerned, it's the same thing. But I often wonder since whether it was LMF or whether it was something, you know, a little more profound than that.
How did they show the so-called lack of moral fibre?
Well, they just refused to fly. Yeah. They just went to pieces and refused to fly.
Did they seem to be in a nervous state?
Oh yes, highly nervous.
How did they show that?
Well, they showed it in as far as they were shaky and almost crying and weeping not to go anymore, you see. But I think they'd had a pretty nasty experience, because there were two from the same crew. But it's the only time I came across it. I bet there were other occasions when it happened with people, but I only came across it that once.
Did the tension accumulate in all sorts of ways in which you were unaware?
Yeah, I think it did. But in those days, I mean, we were all young people. We drank pretty heavily. I'm not saying that we were inebriated all the time, but we did drink fairly heavily, you know, regularly, and I think this helped to dispel some of the tension. And as I said before, you never thought that your name would be on it. You always thought you'd get back.
But would you have alcohol in your system when you went up?
Oh no, no.
Would that have affected your...
Well, that would have affected your judgment. It would have affected your judgment. And I expect sometimes there might have been some certain amount of alcohol in the system. In fact, there must have been sometimes, because if a snap decision was made to carry out a certain raid suddenly, they used to come round and find us wherever we were, whether we were in a dance hall in Scarborough or in a pub in Barmston or Lisset. They'd come and rake us out and tell us we were on. So there would have been odd times when there was a certain amount of alcohol, but I don't think anyone ever would have gone up, you know, actually under the influence of drink like that.
Was tobacco of any help in soothing the nerves?
Yes, I smoked very heavily then. I used to smoke about 50 a day then, for which I'm now paying, I might add.
What was the attitude of the civilian population to the work that you were doing?
Well, they were all for us, of course. In all the local population seemed to know more about what was going on than we did, as a matter of fact, when we were on ops. They'd tell us we were on ops very often.
Was that a security breach?
Well, I think it was. But I don't know whether they read the signs. You know, there might have been certain signs that they were able to read around the airfield, which told them there was going to be an op coming. Yeah.
How many operations do you think you did?
39 I did.
And what was a tour?
Well, the tour used to vary, actually. It depended how well off they were for air crew. If they were very well off for air crew, they would shorten the tour. But if they were hard up for air crew, they would lengthen the tour. And at the stage when I was operating, they were working on a kind of a points system, something like the pools in a way, because you got 3 points, I believe I'm right in saying you got 3 points for a German trip and 2 points for any other, the German being considered the more difficult of the trips. And I forget the actual target number of trips now. I've got an idea. It was around about 85 points you had to have, but I'm not sure about that. But you see, sometimes people almost reached the required amount of points and then they suddenly found they'd had an extra 5 trips slapped on the top, if they happened to need more air crew at the time, you see. So you were never quite sure how many it was. But I did 39 trips.